From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, in this era of Time's Up, casting directors speak out against the idea of the casting couch. Then Alexis Bloom, director of the documentary Divide and Conquer, explains how former Fox News chairman Roger Ailes saw his role.
He's the bulwark against the liberal media elites of Los Angeles and New York who are hell-bent on destroying the country, and only Fox is standing in the way of that.
And an Iranian film composer can't return to his homeland because of a video game. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Casting directors play an important role in Hollywood, and yet rarely are they given any credit. But following allegations that Harvey Weinstein and Les Moonves used the casting process as part of their sexual assaults of women, casting directors are getting a lot more attention, just not in the way that they'd hoped. The Hollywood Reporter's senior film editor, Rebecca Keegan, spoke with a dozen casting directors about how the recent scandals have sparked difficult conversations about their work. And we started with the biggest occupational hazard of being a casting director.
It is when everybody, and I do mean everybody, has a friend or a family member or a colleague who they would like to have an opportunity to audition or get a part. Casting directors just field these kinds of requests all day. And when they come from powerful people like directors or producers or executives, obviously they have to follow through on them.
So let's step back for a minute. Are casting directors typically employed by a studio? Are they typically freelance? And how are actors protected one way or the other once they go into a casting session?
Well, casting directors can be employed by a network or a studio, as is the case with Peter Golden, who is the head of casting for CBS, whom Leslie Moonves asked to often meet with actors and actresses. Casting directors can also be independent, particularly in areas of like independent film. Many of them are. And for many of them, it's a labor of love. It's a hard way to make a living. And they really depend on filmmakers and producers wanting to hire them time and time again, which, of course, makes it difficult sometimes to sort of draw firm boundaries, particularly when it comes to protecting actors, which is something that casting directors really feel it's their responsibility to do.
The New York Times is reporting that former CBS head Les Moonves tried to delete evidence of communications that he had with a manager of a woman who said Moonves assaulted her. How does casting figure into that story?
Well, in that case, Moonves allegedly asked his casting director at CBS, Peter Golden, to find a role for a woman named Bobby Phillips, who's this 50-year-old actress who was living in Canada. I spoke with Golden, who says he didn't know why he was being asked to find a role for Phillips. There was nothing unusual about this request, working in a casting department at a network, particularly for Moonves, who was known to be very involved in casting. It was common to get these kinds of requests.
What has been alleged against Les Moonves is not unique, and that is the promise of a part in exchange for either keeping silent or, as some sort of horrible quid pro quo, I'll do this thing to you, and in return, I'll give you this part or something like that. It's not unique to Les Moonves, is it? The latter sounds like something that Harvey Weinstein has been accused of doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to talk to casting directors about this because they're many of them very sick of the term casting couch. They point out that the kinds of abuses that we're hearing about have not been done by casting directors. They have been done by directors, producers, executives, sort of trying to use the casting process.
Well, that's the other wrinkle in your casting story as it relates to sexual harassment and assault, and that is that people who are not casting directors will use casting sessions as a way to meet someone or, as you report, use an audition as a cover to see women remove their clothes. What did you hear about that practice and how common that might be?
Yeah, I heard from many casting directors about times that they've been asked to either pass along a phone number for an actress. One casting director told me, she said to a director early in her career, "I'm not your pimp, I'm your casting director." If she wanted to give you her number, she would have, which is kind of a bold thing for a casting director to have to say to someone who employs her. Another casting director told me a story of a producer who asked her to leave the room when he was auditioning actresses for a topless scene. She says she refused to leave the room and she lost that job. Other kind of just funny or strange stories. There was a casting director who shared a story of a director who just desperately wanted to meet Maureen McCormick, the actress from The Brady Bunch, and kept suggesting her for roles that made no sense. And it was clear that this was a director harboring a childhood crush, not actually intending to cast a woman. So there are all sorts of sort of bizarre ways in which people have tried to use the casting process for something that has really nothing to do with acting.
And in terms of actors, do actors have worries, too, about what may or may not happen inside a casting session?
Well, one thing that's interesting is how much change there's been in casting in the last decade or so. It's much less common for actors to go in and do a live read. Now, more commonly, they put themselves on video and they send that video in. And that has, according to some casting directors I talked to, cut down on the potential for sort of abuse of that format. There's also been a move away from the idea that an actor would meet a producer or director in his hotel suite to talk about a role. That was a really common way of doing things, and casting directors say they're going away from it. Many times these were completely harmless meetings, but of course sometimes they weren't. And so now apparently, as one casting director told me, they're going to have to start building some conference rooms in boutique hotels in New York because I can't send my actors up to so-and-so's suite anymore.
Rebecca Keegan is a senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. You also hear her on the lot on Take Two every week. She's the author of the story, A Favor for Leslie Moonves, Casting Directors Speak Out on Hollywood's Compromising Culture. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the man who built Fox News was convinced that Osama bin Laden was personally out to get him. The documentary Divide and Conquer, The Roger Ailes Story.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. Joe Morgenstern of The Wall Street Journal says it's fresh from thunderous start to exquisite finish, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. For consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. On July 21, 2016, two major stories converged. Just as Donald Trump was about to accept the Republican Party's nomination for president, the founder of Fox News, the network that not only bolstered Trump then, but also champions him now, resigned.
Blockbuster shakeup at Fox News after 20 years as the network's chairman this morning. Roger Ailes is out.
The man who created conservative-leaning Fox News was forced out over allegations of sexual harassment.
The new documentary, Divide and Conquer, rewinds back from that day and traces the lead-up to his firing by telling the story of Roger Ailes' life. Growing up in Warren, Ohio, Roger Ailes was interested in politics from a young age. He became a powerful figure in Republican campaigns with a track record of big wins for the candidates he worked for, from Richard Nixon to Mitch McConnell. After launching Fox News in 1996, he turned it into the most watched network in cable news. Alexis Bloom is the director of Divide and Conquer, the Roger Ailes story, which is also partly the story of Fox News itself.
He is Fox and Fox is Roger. So we did do a film about Fox, but only insofar as it was connected to Roger. We had to keep on coming back to that central notion of it's a film about Roger. And he encompasses a lot: sexual harassment, sexual abuse, politics, small town America, you know, hemophilia, all of these things in this great big sort of cautionary tale.
Hemophilia is something that he had since he was essentially born. I think he was diagnosed when he was like 4 years old, having hemophilia, and it ultimately actually killed him. But did that change the way that he saw the world, that he was vulnerable?
His old friends going back from childhood say that it affected him deeply, that he said several times, you know, I'm never going to make it past my 20s, that he felt like he was walking around with a ticking time bomb. And people who knew him well said that instead of making him more cautious, it made him more reckless. And that's actually not an uncommon thing with people who have kind of mortal diseases, that they live recklessly, that like every day is their last, let's just go for it.
Roger Ailes was working in television on the Mike Douglas show when President Nixon, who was not President Nixon at that point, came to visit Mike Douglas. Roger Ailes cornered him basically in his office and pitched himself as his media advisor. Why was that meeting so important to what Roger Ailes was going to do, not only in politics, but also in broadcast journalism?
Well, it gave him his leg up, you know, it gave him his leg into politics. It put him in that sort of unique position where he was mediating between the candidate and between the political world and between the broadcast world. And he developed a very nuanced understanding of both.
Good evening, I'm Mike Wallace. For better or worse, television has changed the nature of the political process in the United States. This year, another innovation was tried, the controlled discussion with the questioners picked by the candidate's producer. Roger Ailes was that producer, and in the book, The Selling of the President, he was given a good share of the credit for the successful format.
That was his first job where he sort of meshed, you know, politics and showbiz and saw the potential.
Nuanced is one word for it.
Yeah.
I think there are other words for it. Because one of the things that he does very early on with Richard Nixon is study Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will.
That's right.
One of the greatest and most horrible use of propaganda to support fascism in the history, I think, of mass communication.
That's right.
What did Roger Ailes see, more broadly speaking, in Leni Riefenstahl's work? And how did that apply not only to what he did with Nixon, but also with Fox News?
John, I have to say, you know, we were talking that we both went to Berkeley. You know, I studied Triumph of the Will at Berkeley, and you'd think that that's sort of an unlikely place to study Leni Riefenstahl, but it's a seminal sort of work, and it's, you know, horrific in what it was used for, but incredibly effective, all the low angles to kind of emphasize the power of the face and the structures and, you know, panoramic shots of the crowd. And it was used for horrific ends, but he was smart. He went to the best, and he mimicked that with Nixon and his sort of talks in the round and his placements of the cameras and everything like that. So, you know, he was smart.
We're talking with Alexis Bloom about her new documentary, Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. You talk to a lot of women who have stories about being sexually harassed, and in one case, sexually assaulted by Roger Ailes.
I mean, I knew I was never going to go meet Roger at a hotel. That was unthinkable to me. That was never going to happen. But I didn't know what was going to happen next. I didn't know if I was going to be fired if I didn't do it. I didn't know how he was going to make that happen.
I mean, Roger was the king. His assistant was the head of HR.
And so it didn't occur to me that there was somebody higher than Roger who could have done something. There wasn't.
What was your pitch to them about sharing their stories? Because these are women, in some cases, whose careers were destroyed by not acceding to Roger Ailes' desires.
It's very direct. It's, listen, I think this is what's happened to you. You know, we're doing this film. We would like to tell your story as truthfully as possible and as respectfully as possible. Let's have a conversation off the record first. And they ask me questions about what our film is about, what our approach is, you know, how central they'll be. Are we talking to other people? And, you know, you just approach it in as human a way as possible.
I think everybody can agree, even if they don't like Roger Ailes' politics, that he was a very successful businessman.
Yeah.
He was also a megalomaniac. And I think there are a couple people who talk about that in your film. I want to play a clip from a journalist named John Cook.
Roger Ailes was a profoundly paranoid person. He carried a gun at all times. He was convinced that Al-Qaeda was trying to kill him, that gay terrorists would come attack him. Roger Ailes thought that, like, Osama bin Laden was sitting in his cave, and he had, like, the list of people. And it was, like, George W. Bush and then Roger Ailes.
And there's another moment in the film where Roger Ailes meets President Obama, and President Obama says, wow, the most powerful person in media. And Roger Ailes tells everybody that he said the most powerful person in the world. So what was going on in Roger Ailes' mind about the way that he saw himself in relation to others?
I mean, Roger was a deeply, deeply paranoid person. And I think, you know, the flip side of that is that you matter so much that you have things to be paranoid about. So he's an egomaniac. He thinks he is the most important man in the world. You know, he thinks he's single-handedly saving America on some level. You know, with Fox, you know, he's the bulwark against the liberal media elites of Los Angeles and New York who are hell-bent on destroying the country. And only Fox is standing in the way of that. And by Fox, he means himself. And then, you know, the flip side of that is that, you know, gosh, everyone's out to get me. I'm this, like, you know, lone figure on the battlefield. And everyone's out to get me. And that means, you know, Osama bin Laden. It means the liberals. It means CNN. It means the Bangladeshi accountant at Fox who wanders into his area by mistake. You
and
know.
who is removed from having access to that floor.
Correct.
Just based on the color of his skin.
Yes, and a big wall is built because Roger thinks that this guy was going to come and kill him. I mean, he was actually looking for food. He got an email saying, you know, we had a conference and there's spare food, you know, croissants and donuts. If you'd like, you know, come up to the second floor. And the poor guy, you know, wandered into the wrong area. And, you know, that kind of changed his life.
Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly, who was also accused of sexual harassment and settled the lawsuit filed against him, are gone from Fox News. Mm-hmm. So we may not know if there are still people who are preying on women at Fox News, but the title of your film is Divide and Conquer. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Roger Ailes' view of the world, how much of that view of polarizing the country, playing on the nation's fears, making up stories to make people alarmed and terrified, how much of that is still embedded in the culture of Fox News today?
I mean, I think it continues to be embedded in a very real way. There are people on air at Fox like Shep Smith, springs to mind, who corrects his own network. But the kind of divisionary invective is alive and well with Tucker Carlson, you know. And kind of, I mean, Ann Coulter says the most outrageous things on Fox. A lot of people are given airtime, you know, that's...
Sean Hannity was campaigning for Trump.
Yes, that's right.
And would that make Roger Ailes happy, do you think?
I mean, listen, happy. Roger Ailes was a miserable git. I don't think he was happy. You know, nothing's going to, you know, no amount of Prozac would make him happy. But I think that his key goal was don't lose the audience. Whatever you do, don't lose the audience. And they haven't lost the audience. I think, you know, on some level, you know, Trump wasn't his first choice. Jeb Bush was. He was also mates with Chris Christie. So, you know, he recognized Donald Trump's flaws. But, you know, and I think he would have been a bit dismissive of him in private. But, you know, they haven't lost their audience. Their audience is growing. They were the most watched cable news outfit during the midterms. And he would have been pleased about.
Alexis Bloom is the director and producer of Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. Alexis, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Divide and Conquer is in limited theaters and available on demand starting December 7th. Coming up, we visit the composer who was exiled from Iran for scoring a video game about the Iranian Revolution. Nima Fakhara is one of only three Iranian composers scoring Hollywood films and video games. His work includes The Girl and the Photographs, produced by Wes Craven, and the video game Detroit Become Human. One of the newer games Fakhara wrote music for is about a fateful event in his homeland's history, the Iranian Revolution of 1979, and it's now the reason he can't go home anymore. Frame contributor Tim Grieving has our story.
Nima Fakhara learned how to play the santur before he learned the alphabet.
And you can see it's completely out of tune.
He was born in Tehran, Iran, and he started studying Persian classical music at a very young age.
I was hanging out with a lot of these 70-year-old men that were just kind of, that I had to speak Farsi, and just a very traditional Farsi, not just a day-to-day Farsi. And I was kind of forced into it. I liked it. And I was kind of just became that kid that was like playing music for 8 hours a day.
Let me grab a hammer.
But this is the one you had as a kid.
This is the one that I had as a kid, and surprisingly enough, it's lasted me this long.
I knew that there was music in films and video games because I was so into it. I loved films and I loved video games, but till I moved to the U.S., I didn't know that there is a field in it. And they don't tell you anything in Iran, so it's because of also the restrictions of it. Even nowadays, I don't think there is video game composers in Iran because there's no video games being produced in Iran.
Fakhara's family moved to Maryland when he was 12. He went to college as a pre-med major, but then he went to a party that changed his life.
And we started jamming a little bit, and it was the first time that I felt music in my body. Kind of like I closed my eyes and I just felt the music. It's like you have an out-of-body experience. I wasn't on drugs or anything like that. It was just, I just felt the music. So on my way home, I actually called up my mom. It was like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I called my mom, and I was like, oh, I'm going to be moving to LA to go pursue music.
Which is what he did. He came out here and was studying traditional Western music when he discovered the score for Black Hawk Down by Hans Zimmer.
I realized, Hans is kind of using the traditional Middle Eastern stuff on top of a Western world of, he's using tombak, he's using dulcimers, he's using very, very different worlds. I was like, oh, I could do this.
Fakhara got a job working for Christoph Beck, composer of Ant-Man and Frozen, and he even apprenticed for Zimmer. Then came his own film and video game assignments, like Detroit Become Human. He heard about a game being developed by one of the directors of the Grand Theft Auto series, the Iranian-Canadian Naveed Kansari.
He made a project called 1979 Revolution, Black Friday. The concept of it is that you get dropped into Iran as a journalist, as a student journalist, and then you get to choose your path. You could be part of the regime as part of the police, or you could be the revolutionist as you're kind of walking around taking pictures of things. So I basically called him up 3 years before he was making the project, and I was like, I want to work on this. I got to basically work with him, collaborate on the project with him, and it was very awesome because I was able to bring back some of my root instruments.
The score for 1979 Revolution uses Fakhara's childhood santur and even his voice. But on the day the game came out, it was banned in Iran. And so, effectively, was Nima Fakhara.
Basically, they put a black label on it, as they say. So in Iran, there is a society of arts that there's a bunch of clergies that decide who gets to do any sort of arts or whatsoever. Even if you want to have a concert, you have to have a proposal on what kind of concert you're going to actually put. They listen to your music, they could ban your music. So even if you're making a film, it's the same exact thing. They read your script and they say, this part is banned, you can't do that. So once that happens, if your entire project gets banned, you get on a list that if you go to Iran, you basically kind of, they start questioning you, they throw you in prison, they ask you, why are you talking about the revolution? And that's how I realized, I'm banned from Iran. It's a very weird emotion because I was finally able to work on a project that I wanted to work and be able to kind of go back and actually do something that I loved. But at the same time, it was one of those things that I was like, I knew what I was getting myself into, and I knew I was going to get banned from my own country. And I was like, there's a catch-22 about it. It's like, I want to tell this story, but I know I can't go back to my country.
Fakhara says there's even a chance he'll never be able to return. So lately, he's been channeling his energies and love for Iran into something productive, mentoring aspiring film and video game composers who are in Iran from his studio in Los Angeles using the social gaming platform Twitch.
People watch you play video games, but what I've turned it into is a masterclass. And I go on, basically show a scene that I've done. For example, we started doing it for Detroit.
Thank you everyone for hanging out with us. And then this was supposed to be the main theme, but we never did this. Pew, pew, pew. Oh, that happened already. Cool.
And then all of a sudden, I realized there is, of the like the 50 people that are watching, 10 of them are from Iran. And I'm like, what is going on? So I've basically just kind of started mentoring them a little bit closely, just looking at their music and trying to figure out. Again, it's very indirectly, if not person to person, but I'm trying to kind of give back. I mean, one of my dreams is to be able to work on a project in Iran. I would love to be able to kind of tell my own story that way.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow.